Yeah, thanks for coming in. I'm very excited to visit. So I'm going to be talking about a method to understand many-body systems that's based on measuring entanglement. So entanglement, you all first learn about maybe in this surprising paradox of the Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen. The idea of it is that you have two spins, and the system as a whole is in a definite state. But if you focus on what Einstein here sees, he sees a completely indefinite state, a completely mixed density matrix. So you have this surprise that the system as a whole is in a definite state, but a part of it is in an indefinite state. And that's the basis of a way of understanding many-body systems, which I like to call entanglement spectroscopy. No, I like to call it entanglement scanning tunneling microscopy. So this is a new type of microscope that's mostly useful for theorists. The idea of it is you take your system, and it has hidden in it this entanglement Hamiltonian, this imaginary system that describes the entanglement. You measure that Hamiltonian, and you apply all your theoretical methods to it that you've learned by dealing with real systems, and hopefully you get information about the system, like does it have anions or superconductivity, and what are the phase transitions between these systems, between these states. So far, the main applications of entanglement include a couple of different things. One of them is to distinguish between gapped phases and gapless phases, or to identify critical points. And another interesting application is to understand thermalization. How is it possible that a system starts out at zero temperature, but when you shake it, the entropy increases, even though it evolves in a unitary way? But I'm going to focus on a different application, which is to understand topological phases. Topological phases are states that don't have any order parameter. So you're all familiar with one really common example of a phase without an order parameter, and that's the liquid to gas transition in water. But that's not what I mean by a topological phase. So there's no order parameter, that's true, between the liquid and the gas, but there's not really a sharp phase transition, or there's not a definite phase transition, because it's possible to go from the gas to liquid continuously if you only increase the pressure high enough. So that's not actually what is called the topological transition. A real topological phase transition is a phase that has no order parameter, and there's no way to get from this phase to this phase, no matter how much you vary the parameters. There's always a phase boundary. So that suggests that there's some hidden order parameter distinguishing those phases. And the goal that I want to focus on in this talk is how can you distinguish between these? What I'll show is that there's a signature in the entanglement. The idea is that you take this imaginary entanglement Hamiltonian and look at its spectrum, just the way you would measure the spin of an atom by looking at multiplets in that spectrum. You can do the same thing in the entanglement spectrum. And you see that there's a difference in the multiplicity of the states in the different phases. Well, at first, it's maybe just an experimental fact. But then this entanglement actually gives you a way to prove that you can't avoid it. So once we have this way of distinguishing the phases, that'll let us classify the phases in one dimension, the possible phases with the given symmetry group in one dimension. So I'll explain how that works. So the talk breaks into two parts. First, I'll introduce this entanglement Hamiltonian, which is you can think of as a Hamiltonian describing zero-point fluctuations. And then in the second part, I'll use that Hamiltonian to describe the interacting topological phases or topological insulators. especially in one dimension. So let me start with the entanglement Hamiltonian. What is this thing? Let's start with an example of two spin a half particles that are coupled in some particular wave function. And I want to define an entanglement Hamiltonian that describes the fluctuations of those spins. Now, this state is a definite state. It's not fluctuating. But we know from that example, the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paradox, that if we throw out system B, what's left isn't an indefinite state. So now to define a Hamiltonian, all we have to do is make an analogy to thermodynamics and say, maybe this density matrix comes out as the thermal distribution function of some particle. What would the Hamiltonian have to be for that particle? Well, the relation between the Hamiltonian and a density matrix in ordinary statistical mechanics is given by Boltzmann statistics. We just take the same relationship between our reduced density matrix and the entanglement Hamiltonian and just set the temperature to 1, because that's just an arbitrary number anyway, because it's not real temperature. And once we do that, we get a relationship between this density matrix and these pseudo-energy levels. If we read them off, we get a spectrum, log 3 halves and log 3, and that's the entanglement spectrum of this pair of particles. So far, it's just basically taking the logarithm of the density matrix. It's not very intuitive, but in some cases, there is. Yeah, that's a very interesting question. So I think if you have a gap system, a many-body gap system, it will tend to be local. But I don't think anybody has a proof for that. But also there's some interesting cases where you have Lorentz symmetry where you can actually calculate the entanglement Hamiltonian, and I'll talk about that. So now, like, let's go from this two-body case to a many-body case and get some intuition about what the entanglement Hamiltonian looks like, and also compare it to the physical Hamiltonian. So there's one strong difference of the entanglement Hamiltonian and the physical Hamiltonian. Let's see what that is. Let's take a many-body system, so maybe a magnet with many spins, and we take the entanglement Hamiltonian between region A and the exterior of it, region B. The entanglement Hamiltonian is going to be effectively one dimension less than the physical one because it's only the spins that are near the boundary that are entangled in a strong way with the spins on the other side. So the entanglement Hamiltonian is one less dimension than the physical Hamiltonian because the physical Hamiltonian involves all these spins interacting in an equal way across the whole system. And this fact is related to the area law, which says that the entropy of a region in space, the entanglement entropy of a region in space, is proportional to the surface area. And that idea, that area law, was first introduced by Chudnicki, who wanted to understand the entropy of a black hole as being entanglement between the interior of the black hole and the exterior. Yeah?
I don't mean to disrupt, but it was first introduced by me.
Okay. Okay, thanks. Okay. So, yeah, I know it in this context. But
thank you. Black hole.
Yeah. Okay, thanks. So, so that's what I wanted to say. Thank you. So let's guess what the entanglement Hamiltonian looks like. Since only the degrees of freedom near the boundary are important, so I said that only the degrees of freedom near the boundary are important. That doesn't mean that they're the only ones that exist. It just means they're the only ones that have a low energy. So roughly speaking, the entanglement Hamiltonian you might guess is the real Hamiltonian times the distance to the boundary. So if you assume that, then only the particles near the edge are fluctuating in a strong way. So I'll skip that second picture. But that's a guess for what the entanglement Hamiltonian looks like. But can we actually calculate the entanglement Hamiltonian and see if that's a good guess? From now on, I'm going to mostly focus on one-dimensional systems of spins, and I'll usually cut the system in half just to divide it into two infinite sections. So except one or two times. So first, let's see if that guess I've just made can be justified at all. It turns out for a Lorentz invariant theory, you can actually calculate the entanglement Hamiltonian directly without first solving for the ground state. You can just go straight from the physical Hamiltonian to the entanglement Hamiltonian. And I'm not going to explain how you do that, but I'll give you the intuition behind it. So the idea is that the entanglement Hamiltonian just describes the world as an observer who's accelerating sees it. And the reason is if you're accelerating, there's a part of the universe behind you where the light can never reach you because you're always going faster and faster. So that means that your part of the universe is only, your observable part of the universe is the reduced density matrix for the region that you can see. And therefore, if that's true, you could guess that the entanglement Hamiltonian is just the Hamiltonian in the coordinate system of this accelerating observer. So all you have to do to get the entanglement Hamiltonian is change coordinates. So I've done that for an example. Here's a free scalar field, just a free field with a kinetic term and an elastic energy term. And you do this change of variable, and you find out that the entanglement Hamiltonian is almost exactly the same as the physical Hamiltonian. There's one key difference, which is that the coordinate x is replaced by u, where u is the logarithm of the distance to the cut. So the physical consequence of that is that the entanglement degrees of freedom are sort of deformed. They pile up a lot by the cut, and then they stretch out as you go away. But aside from that, it's exactly the same as the physical Hamiltonian. And the consequence of that is very neat. It says that just from the ground state wave function, you can reconstruct the Hamiltonian. You don't need to know all the excitations. Now, it's only true so far for this particular Hamiltonian. So it's not a very exciting thing that if you're given this Hamiltonian, you can reconstruct it. But it turns out that this relationship of the entanglement Hamiltonian to the physical Hamiltonian applies to any conformal field theory. So just given the ground state wave function of a conformal field theory, you can reconstruct the excited states. So that's just a side comment, but it's neat. Now I want to go over to the case of a gap system, because actually, I guess I should have emphasized, I forgot to say that just now. In this case, the entanglement Hamiltonian was actually one dimension. It's the full dimension of the system. It's just kind of squished in a funny way. But whenever the system is gapped, the entanglement Hamiltonian will be one dimension less than the physical one. So let's add the gap. Yeah.
So this is the one dimensional. What do people find in higher dimension, whether a similar thing like this law of transformation of the boundary to give you this a higher dimensional gapless entanglement Hamiltonian?
Yeah. I think
so similar picture works.
Yeah, it's just it doesn't, you can't do the transformation to make the space be the same space as you started with. It ends up being curved, I think.
You get anti-de Sitter. It becomes space.
It actually becomes anti-de Sitter space.
Yeah, that's hyperbolic.
Okay, that's neat.
No, I don't know. I'm asking.
Oh, I don't know.
But there's no isometry for the external view. I mean, in this case, we're doing the Rinder coordinate thing. Rinder coordinate.
I think the statement is that the entanglement entropy on a sphere is the same as the thermal entropy on an hyperbola.
Okay.
That was the statement of the paper, which was on the top of your
conference. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
But I have a related question. In one dimension, you don't really expect an area law because of the reason that in the gapless case.
Yeah, that's
because
true.
Because of what you said. But in higher dimensions, you would, I think, expect an area law because it'll only be one mode or so on that's really gapless. The transverse momentum or function is a kind of, you know, if you expand in spherical harmonics, say, the L will function as a kind of mass, and you'll have a gap for almost all the modes anyway.
Yeah.
So you still expect an area law.
Unless you have a Fermi surface.
Surface.
If you have a Fermi surface, then you have logarithmic corrections to the area law.
Okay, but the leading term is still the...
It's a logarithmic multiplicative correction. So
oh, I see. Log times the area.
But in the relativistic case, it is still an area law. If you have relativistic symmetry, you would still have an area law.
So does that mean that this entanglement Hamiltonian will be effectively lower dimensional again or not?
I don't know how to think. It's like the space is curved so that the area, maybe it actually gets smaller and smaller in area as you go away from the boundary. So in a way, it is kind of one-dimensional. I don't exactly understand the metric, but from what you say, you can probably understand why it's an area law.
I don't remember the details, but yes. So I don't remember. In the holographic examples, it's because it's dual something with a black hole, and then it is simple. But
I have like a sketch.
In general, aquarium.
Like a way to sketch what it looks like. So, like if we're in two dimensions and we look at the entanglement across this cut, you can picture that the regions that are entangled are sort of. Maybe in each of these little circles, you have a qubit of entanglement between this side of the cut and that side of the cut. And then by the conformal symmetry, or by the scale symmetry, then if you scale this up, that will also contain a qubit of entanglement. And then in each layer, you'll have fewer and fewer of these qubits. So then when you sum, you have like a geometric series, and only these first few layers give it a big contribution.
That is compatible with the area law without correction.
Yeah, so that's where you get the area law without the correction. But then somehow for a Fermi C, you don't have scale symmetry in a Fermi C. Okay, so now I want to add the mass term, which will make it simpler, because then I just have the first layer, basically. So let's take, I'm just going to guess the entanglement Hamiltonian with the mass term. I'll start with a gapless Hamiltonian, the one from before, and I'll just add the mass term, which gives a gap. And I'll just give you an intuitive argument for what the entanglement Hamiltonian looks like. The gap gives a definite correlation length of 1 over the mass. Then you can use the chain rule to convert from the x variable to the u variable of the entanglement space. And that gives you a position-dependent correlation length. Then we rewrite that as a mass by taking the reciprocal, and then just by hand add it back into the entanglement Hamiltonian. That's a guess, but it actually turns out to be correct when you do the Rindler coordinates. Now let's see that this system is effectively one dimension less than the original system. Let's consider some normal modes of this Hamiltonian. This term here is like an exponential potential for those normal modes. And that confines them to the left of this green curve. On the other hand, you have a finite distance cutoff in the original coordinate system. And that becomes this blue wall down at small values of u. So all your modes are trapped between the green curve and the blue wall. So you basically have a particle in a box, which has a discrete spectrum, just like a zero-dimensional system. So in that way, you could see the entanglement Hamiltonian is really confined near the boundary of your original chain when you have a gap. So I just want to give you a quick application of this picture of the entanglement Hamiltonian. I'm going to estimate the fluctuations of the angular momentum of atoms in a subsegment of a chain of spins. So let's consider a bunch of atoms interacting with each other in the ground state. Quantum fluctuations will make their spins fluctuate, so the angular momentum in the segment won't have a definite value. And I want to ask, how do these fluctuations in the total angular momentum depend on the length of that segment and on the correlation length of the state? So my first guess was that these fluctuations would scale as the square root of the length. That's what you would guess if the spins were all independent of one another, because then you just have a Gaussian statistics. But actually, the reason for the fluctuations is that adjacent atoms can exchange angular momentum with one another, and that gives correlations. So the spin should actually be smaller than that. And what's the real answer? Well, we can actually get the answer by looking at the entanglement Hamiltonian. We can estimate the answer without even doing any calculations, and then with some pretty simple calculations, we can get more details. So the entanglement Hamiltonian of that system will, here we take this segment and we look at the entanglement between that segment and the environment. The entanglement Hamiltonian of that segment is basically described by two strings, like the strings of an instrument that can oscillate in two directions. And so they have angular momentum around their axis. Right away, that tells you that the fluctuations are independent of the length of the segment, because these strings have a fixed length at the ends of the segment that you're cutting out because of the entanglement Hamiltonian being one dimension less. So we know the dependence on L is that there's no dependence. Now, how does then the fluctuations depend on the correlation length? Yeah. Oh, the Hamiltonian depends on L, but it's kind of gapped in the middle, has a really big gap in the middle. So it's only the ends that are contributing to the fluctuations. It's like you kind of have, as you increase the length, these two pieces of string move out towards the end, but the length of them is given by the correlation length.
So you're assuming that the correlation length is smaller than the L?
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, if the correlation length, if you have a very long segment compared to the correlation length, then it's only within the correlation length that you have fluctuations.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Which spin are you measuring the fluctuations?
Oh, it's the sum of, sorry, I didn't explain that. It's the sum of all the spins in the segment. So that in the middle it's conserved because they just exchange with each other. Only the ends change. Yeah, thanks. So now I want to just estimate how do these fluctuations depend on the correlation length. Well, right away you can say that it should be proportional to the length of this piece of string, or some power of that, because that's the Hamiltonian that's fluctuating. So the fluctuations should go as this length to some power, and that's logarithmic in the correlation length. If you want to actually get the power law, then you just use the Planck spectrum for the thermal fluctuations of this string. And you can, from that, figure out what those fluctuations are. They go as the square. You can even be more careful and work out the coefficient in front. And that agrees with what you would get by the normal way of just calculating correlations between the spins and the segment. But you can actually go even more farther with the entanglement Hamiltonian. You can calculate the full distribution function of the angular momentum fluctuations and see exactly how does it differ from a Gaussian. And in principle, that's something you can measure in an experiment on rubidium atoms in a one-dimensional optical lattice. So all these calculations are based, that I've been quoting to you, are based on the large n limit of a quantum rotor model. And it would be interesting to take, because in that limit, everything is free scalar fields, so it's simple in that limit. So it would be interesting to look in the limit of a finite value of n, where the nonlinearities are more important, and try to use entanglement to understand how the quantum rotor model works. So let me just summarize what I said about entanglement Hamiltonians. The entanglement Hamiltonian of a gapped d-dimensional system is a system of one dimension less. And the entanglement Hamiltonian can be calculated analytically for Lorentz invariant systems, and it comes out to look like a local Hamiltonian for those systems.
This calculation you just did on the one on the Rubidian,
yeah.
Did you derive the entanglement Hamiltonian, or you use the physical intuition to guess what it would have to look like?
Well, it's a half and half. So, like in the continuum, I can derive the entanglement Hamiltonian, but then the discreteness does something. And there I've basically guessed that all it does is make some boundary condition. And the interesting thing is if you choose free boundary conditions, then your answer agrees with the direct way of calculating it. If you choose fixed boundary conditions, you don't get the right answer. So somehow the boundary conditions are important. So I will start to talk about the topological things now.
Can I ask a question?
Oh, yeah.
So here you start from a vacuum and computed the entanglement.
Yeah.
You start from a thermal system. You still get an entanglement, something like an entanglement Hamiltonian, or something interpolated within the usual Hamiltonian.
Yeah, if you take the density matrix at a finite temperature and calculate it.
Yeah.
I don't know the answer of that. I just seen a paper about like a crossover of entanglement entropy at a finite temperature, which I don't know, which I haven't read, but it's related to that. So you can look and see. Yeah, thanks. But I guess my intuition would be that near the boundaries, the behavior of the entanglement Hamiltonian would be similar. For the finite temperature would be similar to the zero temperature one, and then in the inside it would cross over to the physical Hamiltonian kind of, because in the middle you don't have entanglement anymore, you just have thermal fluctuations. Yeah, I haven't looked at it. So now I want to apply the entanglement to understanding topological phases. So like recently in condensed matter physics, people have been interested in these topological insulators. So what are they? Well, they're topological phases. They don't have any order parameter. But there's more to it than that. And the interesting thing about them is they're materials that are insulating in the bulk. But on the surface, they can conduct electricity. And no matter how much you scratch up the surface, you can't trap the electrons on the surface. The only way to trap them would be to make a trap out of some magnetic material. But without magnetic material, you can't trap the electrons on the surface. So that's an experimental fact, experimental sounding fact. But it turns out that it's related to topology, and whereby topology, I actually mean topology in the sense of mathematics, like the subject that studies toruses and Mobius strips and things like that. So what's that relationship? Let's consider, to start with, an infinite topological insulator. It's made up of a bunch of, and this effect actually is a non-interacting electron effect. So we can understand this ground state wave function by just looking at the single particle plane wave states. So the system is gapped, and that's what makes it be an insulator. And let's look at this example of a two-dimensional system with two orbitals per unit cell. In that case, the Hamiltonian of the system is a 2x2 matrix because there's two atoms per unit cell. And so you can represent it as a constant plus a vector dotted into the Pauli matrices, because that's how you can represent any 2x2 Hamiltonian. And so we have this vector in three dimensions, and it's a function of the momentum. Because we're in two dimensions, the momentum is defined in a Brillouin zone, which has the topology of a torus. So we have a map from a torus into three-dimensional space. That torus could be embedded in different ways. It may enclose the origin, or it may not enclose the origin. Or it might go around the origin 27 times. And those are the only possibilities. But why do we even care about the origin? What about other points? Well, the origin is the point where if this Hamiltonian goes through the origin, the material isn't an insulator anymore, because the gap closes when it passes through the origin. So to go from this state to this state, you have to have a phase boundary somewhere in the middle. You have to have a metallic phase somewhere in the middle. And that explains, I forgot who asked that question, but that explains why these topological insulators are you can't go from the topological phase to the trivial phase without a metallic phase in between.
But this only for free electron.
Yes, that's only for free
electron. There's a, I don't know whether there could be a different story.
Yeah, that's what I want to talk about, yeah. But I just mentioned one interesting thing about this is that this is all bulk property. But there's a connection. If the torus goes around the origin one time, then if you cut a piece of that two-dimensional material, like a little flake, then it will have conducting modes on the boundary that go with one hand in this. And the number of conducting modes on the boundary is equal to the number of times the torus encloses the origin. So you have this surprising situation that you look in the bulk of the material and the plane waves in the bulk, and that tells you what types of bound states you have at the boundary. It's like, I like to picture it like you have a piece of knitting, and if you look at some piece in the middle of the knitting, it's all translationally invariant, but you could guess that if you went to the boundary, you'd see some free loops at the end, and that you better be careful or you will unravel your sweater. So that's just one type of topological insulator. There's a whole table of types of topological insulator. And the usual type people focus on is actually three-dimensional, and it has time reversal symmetry. And it has these sort of helical modes on the surface. This is the type I've just described. The reason why people like this one of the main reasons, is that it's been seen experimentally. You can see in this ARPES picture the actual modes on the surface. Yeah?
Two questions. So if you try to like scratch up the surface, like what you said, that like, it cannot trap the electrons. So what if you make an island on the surface? Like, but you will. What would happen?
Well, if you try to cut, if you cut out like a moat or something, then you'll just create new conducting surfaces in the moat.
Base layer, yeah.
The place you uncover will become conducting.
Also, what do the torus represent when in that picture, once you map the torus in K1, K2, those are wave modes?
Yeah.
And then you map it to something else. Like, what does the surface of that torus represent?
What does that space represent?
Yeah,
that's the space of the Hamiltonian. The three coordinates are like the three coordinates you need to describe a 2x2 Hamiltonian.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. So and then there's one more interesting example, which is in one dimension, if you have superconductivity, you can have a state that has these fractionalized Majoranas at the end. And these are neat because it's like a fermion that's split between the two ends of the system. It's a single fermion. So there's no way to tell whether that fermion is there without measuring both ends simultaneously. And people think that's a good way to make quantum computers because the occupation number of that combined fermion would make a good qubit because it can't decohere unless you have some non-local thing that measures both ends simultaneously. And that also might have been seen in Leo Kaulenhoven's group in Delft. So as you asked, so far we had to use to understand topological insulators, we had to be able to solve the Hamiltonian in terms of plane waves. But what if we have interactions? We wouldn't be able to use that method anymore, and the torus wouldn't be defined. So how could we understand interactions? The first step is that we have to find a way of distinguishing between the phases in the in the ground state wave function. A guess is, what do you have? You don't have any long-range order, so you don't have a local order parameter. All you have is fluctuations. So a simple guess is that we should look at the entanglement and use that somehow to recognize the state. Now, the entanglement Hamiltonian looks similar to the physical Hamiltonian that we thought at the beginning. So are these surface states that conduct electricity reflected somehow in the entanglement spectrum? So we started first with a free system. And we found that the surface states look like this. And when you calculate the entanglement states, they also have a Dirac point. The details aren't the same, but topologically they have the same look. And you can give a mathematical argument that shows that any property of the physical spectrum that's topological has to be reflected in the entanglement spectrum. So far, it's still for non-interacting electrons. But the next step is to go to interacting systems and see if the same thing works. We're going to stick to one dimension because that's easier, since then the entanglement Hamiltonian is just zero dimensional. And we'll first test this out on a spin one chain. That's because a spin one chain is analogous to a topological insulator in the sense that it has a fractionalized state at the edge. This is something people have actually seen experimentally. There's a material, it's NENP it's called, that has spin one atoms in it. But when you do electron spin resonance on it, you see these doublets, just as if there were spin one halves at the ends of the chain. Even though you can't make spin a half out of spin ones, no matter how many spin ones you put together by the Clebsch-Gordan laws. So that's what we're going to test out the ideas on. We're going to find the following classification of one-dimensional phases. So in ordinary phases that have a symmetry breaking, the first step to describe the phase would be to list the symmetries. Then in the Landau classification, you would list which of those symmetries are broken. And that would define your phase. Now in our case, there aren't any broken symmetries, so we have to do something more refined. We have to find how the symmetries act on the entanglement spectrum. It'll turn out that some extra phase factors will appear, and these phase factors will characterize the phase of the one-dimensional system. And that's the classification. That's one way to classify one-dimensional phases. In principle, there could be other order parameters, but these two papers have shown that that's the only way to classify the phases. There aren't any other order parameters. Any two phases that have the same phi values have to be continuously connected to each other somehow in phase space.
Yeah. You mentioned a couple of times about continuous connection. Yeah. There's some background assumption here that maybe one is in an infinite system and the interactions are just local.
Yes.
Or something like that.
Yes. Yeah, and you can.
And if you allow completely free changes, you could go from any phase to any phase.
Right, that's true. So we're assuming it's an infinite system. And when I say it's a disc, when something happens discontinuous, by discontinuous, I mean that a gap closes somewhere along the path. So two points are in the same phases if there's a continuous way to go between them without the gap closing in an infinite volume. Yeah?
I have a naive question. So normally in the symmetry breaking theory, you look at the action of the symmetry group on ground state space.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, you instead of looking at that, you said that one, everything is a trivial representation. I mean, mm-hmm. but now you let the symmetry group act on the entanglement entropy instead. Or
entanglement spectrum.
Spectrum, yeah. So that's the only difference? How is it possible for the symmetry group as trivial, like trivially, act trivially on the ground state space, but not trivially on the entanglement?
Yes, that's exactly what happens.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks. That's a good question, I think. So let's start with an example of this spin one chain. We're just going to add some two parameters to it, just so that we can get a two-dimensional phase diagram, basically. I mean, you have to choose some interesting parameters, but basically we want a two-dimensional phase diagram. And in this phase diagram, we'll find a whole bunch of phases. But two of these, the Haldane phase and the trivial phase, don't have any symmetry breaking in them. Yet, as you go between them, there's a point where the gap closes. So why is that happening? Is there an order parameter that distinguishes between them? Well, let's take the chain and divide it in half and look at the entanglement between the two halves. We find that the entanglement spectrum in the Haldane phase has double degeneracies at every level. Whereas for the large U phase, the lowest level is a singlet and some of the other ones are as well. It almost looks as if the symmetry has changed between the two cases, but we know that's not true because we checked and there isn't any difference in the symmetry. So how can we understand these doublets and how can we understand the action of the symmetries on these entanglement states? Well, if we take a segment in the chain and look at the entanglement between that segment and the environment, only the ends of the segment are fluctuating a lot. And that means that when you apply a symmetry to that segment, you can think of it as a product of a symmetry on the left side with a symmetry on the right side that are independent of each other because the ends are so far apart from each other. Now, the crucial point about this factorization is that it's not unique. There's an ambiguous phase factor, because you could take an I out of the second factor and move it over into the first factor. And that's going to let us distinguish between phases. You'd usually think a phase factor isn't so important, but here it really is important. So if you take any symmetry group, the physical symmetries will have some algebra. In the entanglement spectrum, the algebra will be just the same, except there'll be some phase factor, rho, that depends on the two symmetries, I and J. This is similar to the representation of SO3 rotations by rotations of a spin a half particle. You know, as when you do a 360-degree rotation on physical space, you get back the same thing. But in a spin a half particle, you pick up a minus sign. And these phase factors are very similar. So let's see how we can use these phase factors to distinguish different phases. At first, you might think that the phase factors are useless because they're just phase factors. But I'll show that some of these phase factors have a unique value that you can't eliminate. Let's start with a single axis of symmetry with an order n. So in the physical system, the nth power is equal to the identity. In the entanglement system, you have the same relationship, but with a phase factor. But that phase factor can just be absorbed into a redefinition of U. Now let's look at another case. Let's say we have two 180-degree symmetries around perpendicular axes. Usually, if you have rotational symmetries in three dimensions, they don't commute with one another. But this is a special case. You can check if you have a book or a laptop. You can try rotating 180 degrees around the perpendicular axes, and you'll find that they do commute. So nobody's trying. It's hard to do.
I'm sure you're right.
Yeah. So. The interesting thing that you, when you try it out, the thing you'll notice is that your book might pick up a phase of minus one. You didn't know that.
No, it did.
Oh, it did. Yeah. So it picks up a phase. What's that?
It reversed.
But it should, the book should come out the same. What? Yeah, it should come out, the book should come out the same, but there might be a phase of minus one. That phase tells you whether you have an even or an odd number of fermions in your book. So if we apply that same idea to this classification of phases, the value of this phase phi tells you which of the two topological states you're in. You can see this phase can't be absorbed like this row, because if I try to rescale ux, you affect both sides of the equation in the same way, and that means phi is uniquely defined. You can do the same type of classification for time reversal symmetry and invergent symmetry. In both those cases, you find two phases. But if you have more complicated groups, you can find more complicated phases. And the set of phases, you can read about it in this paper here. The set of phases is classified by the second cohomology group of the group of symmetries. That's the mathematical name for this set of types of representations with phase factors. So that's the classification of one-dimensional phases. I'll just give you one interesting example of that, of this classification. Because so far, we've classified the phases. That's useful. But the entanglement spectrum hasn't really helped that much, because we could have just started by focusing on the physical edge states instead of the entanglement states. Here's a case where the entanglement gives you more information than the edge states. Let's take a system that just has mirror symmetry, like the reflection symmetry, assuming this weren't here. This would have the reflection symmetry in that point. Yeah?
So before you go to this, what are some of the groups in reality? I mean, you gave some finite subgroup,
yeah,
and
some
the rotation
simple
group and so on.
Yeah.
Which ones actually occur?
I think basically the ones I had. So like, you could have particle number conservation, which is a U1 symmetry. And you can have time reversal or inversion symmetry. Those are the most natural ones. And then you could also have spin symmetry in some approximation. So that's like the most useful ones, I think.
Spin symmetry means the rotation group?
Yeah, the SL3 symmetry.
The full SL3?
Yeah.
Not.
Yeah, usually SL3 would break down to something discrete because you have some, if you have a crystal, that breaks the symmetry. But if the spin orbit coupling is weak, you still have the SO3 symmetry approximately. The spin is independent of the shape of the crystal. Yeah. Thanks. So the interesting thing is when you put those different groups together simultaneously, then you can get some pretty complicated sets of phases. Yeah, like lots of different. So if you have just this inversion symmetry, then the end of the system doesn't have inversion symmetry. Just the center does. So the edge spectrum doesn't reflect the symmetry. Only the entanglement spectrum does, and that means that with the entanglement spectrum, you can distinguish between two different phases. What's the intuitive meaning of these phases? Well, there's an experiment you could do to distinguish between them. Well, it's not really an experiment. It's more like a thought experiment. You take your system and you separate it at a bond adiabatically. Usually you'd think that the entanglement would decay to zero as you separate it very far apart. But that's not what happens in the topological state. In the topological state, the entanglement just decays to logarithm of 2. Because no matter how far the system is separated, you have a doublet. You have basically an EPR pair that's entangled between the two ends of this cut. So the correlations remain no matter how far you separate the chain. So far we just classified the states. And we have a way to distinguish them based on entanglement, but that's not an observable property in an experimental sense. Can we actually find some operator whose expectation value distinguishes between the phases? That sounds hard at first because we have to calculate these phase factors by taking commutation relations between these U operators in the entanglement spectrum. And do we have any access to the U operators? Well, if you apply a rotation or any of the symmetries all along a segment, that automatically applies a U operator at the right end and the V operator at the left end. So we do have some access. Unfortunately, if we just calculate the commutator, we get the U's and the V's simultaneously, and the phase factors from the two ends cancel out. So you can't tell the difference between the two phases. But there's something a little But there's a surprising solution to that. You just take four copies of your system, which are completely independent of each other. And then you apply the rotation in the middle, but to different segments. And then you do permutations of the ends. And what these permutations allow you to do is to multiply the U's in a different order on the left end and on the right end. So on the left end, when you take the expectation value, you'll get a product of UI, UI dagger, VI, UJ, UJ dagger. It cancels out. On the right end, you get the commutator you wanted.
What do you mean by permutations of the end? You know, what I try to say is that this RI, RJ is well-defined operator on the segment of string.
Yeah.
And but then the arrow you draw, I don't understand in terms of an operator.
Let me explain what the operator actually means. We have, in the red segments, we just apply the symmetries. On the blue segments, we have an extra symmetry, which is permutations of the different strands. And on the right end, we're going to apply a four cycle, just kind of cycle the four strands. On the left end, we'll do two cycles. And what the two cycles or the four cycles do is they take these U's or V's and bring them next to each other in a way. The neat thing about it is that you start out with these uncorrelated segments, and somehow you, by measuring this operator, you make them become correlated. So basically we do this, we measure the eigenvalue of this permutation operator. After the measurement, the segments in the middle are correlated to each other. And so these operators don't commute anymore. So and that way you can measure this phase factor. So it's like we do the measurement, that creates the correlation we need, and then we measure that correlation.
Ari?
Yeah.
Are you thinking that you have a matrix product state representation here, or is this a physical?
This is a physical thing. Okay. Yeah, so you could actually like measure the eigenvalues of these operators and just average over many measurements. And what you would find if you could take the ratio with the symmetries and without the symmetries. And the ratio would be plus one or minus one, depending which of the phases you're in.
Do you have to fix the boundary condition at the minus plus infinity?
You should be careful. You should actually apply the permutation only to a finite segment. You shouldn't go all the way out to infinity.
I see. So this operator acts on a longer segment. First I have a pi a, then you have this rotation, then another pi b.
Yeah. Or before pi a, you would have the identity. Then you have pi a, then you have.
Okay.
And then you don't have to worry about what
so
happens.
So the whole system can be a ring.
Yeah, or it could be a ring. So the nice thing about this operator is that we can reinterpret it in terms of topology. And this actually gives a reason for calling these phases topological in the first place. You can represent the wave function by a path integral, the wave function of one copy of the chain by a path integral in a half plane. So we do the path integral from minus infinity time to zero. And this will give us a partition function that depends on the boundary conditions. And that function represents the wave function of this chain. And if you choose the action correctly, you'll get the ground state wave function. Now to calculate the expectation value I just described for you, we need 8 copies of this half plane, because we need 4 for the bras and 4 for the cats. So we take these 8 copies, we apply the rotations, and we apply the permutations. Now, the permutations make this thing into one of those kits that you may have played with, where you cut something out of cardboard, and you glue the tabs together in the right way, and if you're lucky, you get like an icosahedron. And if you're unlucky, you get something that exists in 5 dimensions, and you fall into a black hole. But in this case, if we glue them together in the right way, we get a torus. And the places where the rotations apply act like branch cuts on the torus. And these branch cuts form closed loops. And that fact is really important because it means that you can move these closed loops around without changing this partition function. which means that this partition function is a topological property. It just depends on the topology of this torus and on the topology of the wave function. And that explains in a different way why this ratio is a topological number. It's robust within any given phase. So that's like a space-time reinterpretation of what I was showing you in the operators language. So now I just want to go back to this original question of what happens when you add interactions to a topological insulator. But is there some questions? Since I start to near the end of the time, I should see what you would like to know. Okay, I'll go on to talk about topological insulators with interactions. So the classification I've described only works in one dimension so far. I mean, I've been describing it in one dimension. So let's describe it for, let's apply it to one-dimensional topological insulators. An interesting example in one dimension is superconductors with time reversal symmetry. When you use the free electron classification, you find that these states are classified by an integer that describes the number of Majorana particles at the ends of the chain. So there's infinitely many phases.
About a topological superconductor instead of a topological insulator.
Oh yeah, sorry, it's a topological superconductor. It has a gap, but that's a gap in the fermion. Right. So without interactions, there's infinitely many phases. But when you add interactions, Witkowski and Kataev showed that the number of phases goes from infinity to 8. You can picture it something like this. You have a phase diagram with the hopping on one axis and interaction on the other axis. By changing the interaction parameter, you can continuously go from the state classified by the number 8 to the state classified by the number 0. And that means that these phases are only classified by an integer modulo 8. The original classification was based on the properties of like the SO8 symmetry group. But we can actually use our symmetry classification in a simpler way to understand that effect. So can we apply our theory to the topological insulators? Well, like the only difference between topological insulators and the spin chains I've been describing so far is really that they have fermions in the system. And there's two consequences of that. The first is that there's a fermion parity, which is +1 for an even number and -1 for an odd number of fermions. And that's always conserved, because you can't have a state that has a superposition of an odd and an even number of fermions. And then aside from this automatic conservation law, there's another property, which is that operators that are far away are not necessarily independent of each other. They can have statistical relations. They can anti-commute. And that implies that if you have just this symmetry, this parity symmetry, then there's two phases of topological superconductor. Even though in the bosonic case, if you had a single symmetry, you would have only one phase. Fermions are a little bit different. The example that Kataev and Witkowski studied involves time reversal symmetry in addition to the parity symmetry. When you put those together, you just have to use the method I was explaining before. The algebra of the operators on the entanglement spectrum can have two additional signs. When you put all these three signs together, you get 8 phases. And that explains why there's 8 phases of these topological superconductors.
What group was this?
It was Z2 plus Z2. Yeah. It's just one Z2 is fermions and one's time reversal. That matters a little bit.
Because the time reversal is anti-unitary. And
yes. Right. And the fermion also matters because it's connected to the anti-commutation of the operators.
Yeah.
So let me summarize this one-dimensional phases. One-dimensional phases, first of all, can be distinguished by the Schur phase factors that appear in the representation of the symmetries on the entanglement spectrum. I forgot to explain this, but when you have the non-trivial Schur phase factors, you automatically have the degeneracies in the entanglement spectrum that I showed you in that numerical result on the entanglement spectrum. But these degeneracies don't give you a complete distinction between phases. You really have to know all these Schur phase factors to know for sure what. This is a very confusing sentence. You have to know all the Schur phase factors to know for sure which phase you're in. And to measure the Schur phase factors, you can use those expectation values of the permutation operators. And then last of all, we can classify topological insiders with interactions by using this method. And we see that interactions change the classification. So what else can you use entanglement for? Well, this is the question I asked about the entangling, scanning, tunneling microscope. What can we learn if we've gotten an entangling, scanning, tunneling microscope? Here's some ideas. It may be the case that some physical response properties match with entanglement response properties. If I apply an electric field to a system, there's an effect called the magneto-electric coupling in which the system becomes magnetized. And that effect is pretty likely to be related to a response property of the entanglement spectrum. I'm saying that because this effect, it's a bulk property. It's determined by the bulk Hamiltonian, but you only see it on the surface. So it's very similar to the edge modes of the topological insulator, but it's more quantitative because it's actually a proportionality between the electric and the magnetic response. And then another question we could try to study is, what are the transitions between these topological phases? So far, I've just given you a list of phases. But it would be more interesting to see when you go from one phase to another, you have some critical modes. How do those interact with each other? And at a critical point, what phases do you have around that critical point? My feeling is that at the critical point, these imaginary degrees of freedom in the entanglement spectrum kind of become deconfined and they become real degrees of freedom. So if you have a phase that has an integer spin on the end, and you didn't make a transition to a half-integer spin on the end, then it looks like, at the critical point, a channel opens up in the bulk that allows a spin a half to come in and change the spin of the boundary. So those spin a halves would be the degrees of freedom at the critical phase. So that's some questions we could try to understand with entanglement. And I just wanted to mention some other things, in case you're interested, since I'll be around a couple of days, of things I worked on. Maybe I'd like to discuss them with you if you're interested. So I've done some work on cold atoms. In particular, I was studying Bose condensates of atoms with spin. And I had a way to picture the phase diagrams of spinners with many components in terms of geometrical shapes. Then I've also done a lot, kind of partly connected to entanglement, of work on the surface properties of materials. So I studied, I helped come up with this idea of the surface state on a vial semi-metal. And also I've been working on a formula for the magneto-electric coupling. And then I'm also interested in finite temperature things, like, or maybe not even finite temperature, just fluctuations in general. Can you use defects as a statistical measure of a signal? For example, can you use it to understand cosmic background radiation? And then an idea which is just an imaginary idea so far, is can you understand the jamming transition, for example, of grains of sand by using an analogy with entanglement? Because jamming is also a phase transition in finite temperatures, where there's no water parameter that people know yet. So maybe entanglement would help you uncover that. But that's just so far just a guess. So let me just summarize. The entanglement Hamiltonian of a gap d-dimensional system is one dimension less than the real Hamiltonian. And you can use it to distinguish between topological phases. And can you use it for anything else? That's the last question. You have some
questions?
More questions?
Can you go back to that permutation of the four?
Yeah.
And say, I didn't quite follow. Exactly, what experiment would you really do? I mean, could you say in
yes.
a little more detail how you would set up that experiment?
Yeah. So it's not, yeah. So what you would do, you would take four copies of the system, and like at each.
So they'd be finite length strings.
Yeah. Let's say they extend past the figure. So you only apply the permutations over a finite segment. So what you do is you look at each site of the chain, and there's four copies of that site. And you can, for that site, you can measure the eigenvalue of the product of these three rotations because it's an observable operator. And you can also also measure the eigenvalue of the permutation matrix on each of the sites.
Yeah, that's the part I don't. How do you measure the this means physically permuting the strings, or how do you measure?
Yeah, I don't know how you measure. It's an observable because it's the real and imaginary part of the permutation commute with each other. But I don't actually know the practical way to measure it. But it's an observable. Then you just multiply all those phase factors together and take the expectation value. But it's not super practical, because if you make any small errors, the errors are going to wipe out the effect and you'll just get an average of zero. But in principle, it's an improvement over the original entanglement. Yeah?
Yeah, so the method you described about using the symmetries and how they act in the spectrum, entanglement spectrum, can you use that higher dimensions, to some extent?
Yes, yeah, so there's a classification of Professor Wen and Xia Chen also. They understand a lot of the topological phases in two dimensions using with a sort of a set of phase factors. And there's a way, like I'm thinking of a way. I've been working on a way to understand that that's kind of analogous to this.
Yeah.
So the basic idea is if you take a region in a two-dimensional system and you apply a symmetry to that region, you can try to write that symmetry as a product of a symmetry on the two sides of that region. But there'll be a difference from the one-dimensional case. Because now these two, they're not like the two ends of a chain, because they overlap at these two points. So now the ambiguity won't be just a phase factor. It'll also be some transformation. And if you work through with that, you can actually get to the third cohomology like group. So that it comes out with the same classification that you have. It would be nice to be able to understand also phases with a chiral central charge, because that's something that people don't understand so far, I think.
So you can do it for both fermions and bosons?
In some examples, like I can understand the spin Hall effect using this kind of method. But I haven't tried to do all the fermion examples, because I actually don't understand the cohomology for fermions. Yeah, so I did it by examples.
That's not published anywhere.
No, yeah, it's some recent thing.
So you talked about the relation between the non-interacting and the interacting theory. So I guess Xiaogang and others had classified that was for the non-interacting
no.
that classification.
No, then
that's complete for.
Well, the non-interacting one is is going back to like Kataev and Shinsei Ryu.
I see. Well, I wasn't asking
yeah.
who did it exactly.
Yeah, it's a separate thing.
But you showed that you got a sort of Z that collapsed to Z mod 8
yeah.
or something like that. So how do you know that, I mean, was that general or is it a particular kind of interaction? How do you know if you introduce other kinds of interactions, it won't collapse further?
Yeah, that's the thing. That's the argument. No, well, we know it can't collapse farther because the symmetry argument works no matter what type of interactions you have, as long as they're local.
As long as the symmetry remains.
Yeah, as long as the symmetry remains. What you could worry about is there might be two states with the same set of phase factors that you could that would also be in different phases. Like there might be a finer subdivision. Yeah, and that's what like Professor Wen and also Shi Chen has shown. And also Norbert Schuch. So that's also true. In higher dimensions, though, you can have distinct phases for other reasons than symmetry. But in one dimension, this is the only distinction between phases.
Also, I had a comment. It's might or might not be relevant, but mathematicians are very interested in what you call entanglement Hamiltonian.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they call modular operator, uh-huh. modular automorphism. Or something. They study it a lot in the context of usually infinite dimensional W-star algebras and things like that. I'm just wondering, has there been any interaction between those two sets of work? You know, have people ever looked at this one way, or have they looked at this?
Yeah, I
don't see if they can make connections.
All I've done is I've heard the word the modular operator. It was in, but I don't know how. I don't know the answer. I don't know how much people have talked to each other. I haven't.
The thing I know is that the Rényi entropy of say XY chain is a modular invariance.
That's a different modular.
Yeah.
Okay. That's a different
it's not
use of the word
modular. No, I mean, it's a
modular. Right. That's the same word, but it has a different I don't know why they call it modular operator. Modular automorphism group is usually the word one hears are modular flow.
Yeah. So it's like you
it's
can.
It's not the modular group. It's not Z, SL2Z or something.
Yeah.
But also, I was intrigued. You said something about the CMB spectrum application.
Yeah.
I don't know if it has to do with this talk, but I'd be interested
to
know what that referred to.
Maybe I should. I don't know if people want to leave, I can.
There's another talk.
Yep. We'll be kicked out in a few minutes, actually.
We should stop.
Yeah.
We should.
I can just tell you about it. Thank you. So, thanks. Okay.